decided to keep on with what we're talking about with quantum information related topics in condensed matter, and especially in the context of tensor network wave functions, mainly MPS, matrix product states. And then I'll probably touch on briefly on some other tensor networks that people are looking at beyond matrix product states. But let's keep setting up some properties that matrix product states have. And maybe by the end of today and definitely tomorrow, we'll talk about entanglement, and that will help us to understand better why these other states beyond matrix product states had to be invented and what their job is in going to 2D or dealing with critical systems. So just to review, that's just like a drawing of an MPS for you guys to refer to. And just to get some terminology straight, people talk about the physical or site indices as being the ones that actually, remember, this is some decomposition of a many body wave function. So in general, a many body wave function will have a ton of different legs. This is like the amplitudes, right? So when I say wave function here, it's in the sense of, you know how like in quantum one, you talk about wave functions in real space. So that's like really what you're doing is you're dealing with a function that's it's an amplitude function, right? But then we can also think of wave function as like a ket in some abstract Hilbert space. So here, this is like the amplitude. So this is a wave function in the, say, spin basis, or it could be particle number basis on some lattice, something like that. And so we talk about the physical or site indices as the ones that are really there, even on the, sort of true form of the full wave function. And we take these to have some fixed dimension little d. And so for spin 1/2, that would be 2. For spin 1, that would be 3, so on. For fermions, spinless fermions, it would be 2. And then we talk about the bond indices or the virtual indices inside, just different names floating around in the literature. You can call them matrix indices. And we talk about these indices as having a size capital D. Sometimes you'll see this called M or chi, depending on the person writing the paper. Okay, and M is common in DMRG literature, and capital D or chi is common in tensor network state literature. And I should point out that these bond dimensions can vary. Okay, so for the purposes of what we're talking about, let's think of them as all being the same. And if some are smaller, let's just artificially make them bigger up to whatever the biggest one is in the system. But in general, they can vary, like in practical calculations. You might want to try to save some cost by letting some of them be small if they don't need to be any bigger. And today we're going to talk a lot about doing calculations, doing measurements. Okay, and this may seem like a little bit technical, but it's actually pretty instructive if you're going to work with these, and it will give you a feeling for what nice properties they have that we want to reproduce in other ansatzes for other tensor network states. We haven't always succeeded at this, but there are some classes, say, like they go to 2D, like this Mira ansatz that has some of these same nice properties. The PEPS sort of lacks these properties, and we'll also see some. We'll see what kind of variational class this is by considering the kind of measurements. So for instance, what we're building up to today is we're going to look at correlation functions, and we'll see what kind of correlation functions generically you can get from an MPS, and then we'll see that there's certain kind that naturally you can't get from an MPS of a finite bond dimension. So that's where we're headed. Let's think briefly about how to do this in the non-tensor notation. So this will be a little bit painful, but let's just see it so that we can understand what we're doing a little better, and also to see the advantage of this tensor network notation. So consider a single site operator, which it's helpful to remember. So here we're thinking of an operator O that acts on site J. All right, and it's helpful to remember that this is actually shorthand for actually a big multi-site operator that's really a tensor product of a bunch of single-site operators. Okay, so it's really an identity on every site and then something other than an identity on site J. That's really what that is, right? So it's helpful to remember that. And remember that the same state that I wrote on this board over here is really um, writing it in a more conventional language, it's really some product of matrices that have labels. So you can think of these as collections of matrices. Or remember, we talked about they can also be thought of as rank three tensors. You can switch back and forth to whatever view is most helpful. And here, I'm leaving the boundary conditions vague and unspecified for now. Okay, so we can think of this as actually an infinite system, or we can think of this last matrix as being d by 1 and the first one as being 1 by d, whichever helps you, but it doesn't. You don't have to specify it until we get into some further details in a minute. And stop me if that becomes confusing, if you need to think about a certain boundary condition, but again, if it helps open boundary conditions, that'd be the simplest. Think of the first guy as being a 1 by d matrix, then the internal ones as being d by d, and the last one as being d by 1, if that helps you. Okay. Open periodic, I think that's about it, right? Well, infinite, right? So this is actually kind of, this is one of the incredible things about, yeah, so that's a good question, because this leads to that point, so that you can have open, you can have periodic, where you would have a trace over the first and last index. You can also have infinite, where you just never really think of this chain of A's as ending. And in that case, it's helpful to, you have to define some unit cells. So you might have A1, A2, A3. I put a 1 on this guy for some reason. A1, A2, A3, something, 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 and then it repeats. It has to eventually repeat, basically, for this thing to be well-defined, I believe. And there, just as a comment, we're not going to talk about this right away, but we can talk about this later. How do you deal with these infinite ones? Is that you in some sense, you think of them as being open, but having some kind of unspecified boundary conditions at some unspecified distance very, very far away. And we'll see today that that finite bond dimension matrix product states generically have some kind of correlation length in them, even if you don't want them to. You sort of can't avoid that if they have a finite bond dimension. So eventually, if you push past that correlation length, it really doesn't matter what boundary conditions you put. So what you do is you just push that way off, and then you basically compute some kind of dominant eigenvector that comes from pushing some arbitrary vector through an infinite number of these guys. And then that is like having an infinite system for all intents and purposes. So you really can do infinite systems. It's pretty amazing, because you can even like do real-time evolution on infinite systems. You can actually set up an infinite wave function and then evolve it in real time and track how it evolves without any finite size effects. Kind of interesting. So people, this is one reason why people are really interested in taking this technology or some variant on it into two dimensions, because two dimensions in some sense is a big frontier in condensed matter physics. We don't have many methods that can deal well with strongly correlated systems in 2D. 3D, every site has more neighbors on a lattice model, so mean field theory tends to work better. So, you know, we'd like to do better in 3D as well, but 2D is really tough and full of interesting physics. Also, it's in some sense where the high TCs live, so it's a big target for that reason as well. So when we put together this Bra and Ket in the Bra wave function, we get conjugate A's, and I'm putting primed indices. And then in the Ket, I'm putting unprimed. Okay, I've dropped the identities again, but it's important to remember that they're there. Okay, and for when we draw this thing as a tensor network, so just remember that. And what we see here is that there's no operator acting between, there's just an identity operator acting between S1 primed and S1. There's just an identity operator acting between S2 primed and S2. So we get a delta S1 primed S1, we get a delta S2 primed S2, and so on for every site that's not J. So then these become the same index, this becomes the same index, et cetera, et cetera. All right. So we can write this, we can rearrange this in a more suggestive way.
So we can sum over all these site indices. We can think of doing the sums locally and individually and before we do the rest of the calculation. And then somewhere when we reach site J, we have a slightly more complicated contraction to do, not much more. I'm just writing this out so that when we draw it, you'll really understand what every piece means. Okay, so we basically have a really similar looking object here that just has some kind of dummy index that differs. You know, so at this point, once you've summed over S2, this A was the same A. By assumption, we were taking a translation invariant in PS. So this object, whatever, once you've done the sum over S1, this is just some object. Okay, this is the same object, et cetera, et cetera. And we just have some funny impurity object here that's different from all the others. Well, these are just complex conjugate for now. You can write it in terms of Hermitian conjugate if you reintroduce the matrix labels and then pay attention to what order they're in. I'll draw it, and that'll make it the whole thing much more concrete when I draw it in a second.
I've got like a product of matrices on the left. Mm-hmm. Just insert matrices in between.
You're confused about...
like you've done a deep rearrangement of your matrices in this.
Yeah. Right, well, I haven't said sort of what the matrix labels are doing. So this is, let's just say this is schematic, and I'll draw it. And I can come back to this notation. Basically, part of my point is this is a horrible notation to work in. But I wanted you guys to see that this collapse of this sites around this operator happens, and that you get something that is like another tensor, which is Sj, S around O. All right, I could put in all the indices, but let's just draw it now. Okay, and then that should clear up what we're doing a little better. So let's define something that is this so-called impurity tensor, which holds this operator. I'll come back to that if you guys want to revisit it in a second. Let's draw it first, and then I'll come back. And let's define a straight line, just to be clear. If we just draw a line connecting two tensors, you can think of it as just the extension of the indices of those tensors contracting with each other. But you can also think of a straight line as being a tensor itself, which is just a delta function tensor. Or if you want, it's the matrix elements of an identity operator. All right. So then that same messy thing that we wrote up there becomes this tensor network. Okay, so we see that this little box is just some matrix tensor that is the matrix elements of this operator O, right? So you know, if we had put the SZ operator here, this would be a half minus a half with these two indices the same, okay? Depending on which two values they took, that kind of thing. And so you can see that all we've done is this is the Ket wave function at the bottom. Right, and then the Brauwe function on the top, we've flipped over and we've just sandwiched it around this operator. Then on these other sites that are not site J, this is site J, we've put, either you can think of that we've put these identity operators, like as I wrote out the true form of O as being a string of identities, O, and then another string of identities. So you can think of all these as actually identity operators, or you can just think of there as being no operator there. And so there's nothing to put in between, so these two lines come from the two MPS tensors and just connect and contract. Right. So hopefully this clears up what's going on with the rest of those indices of the A, because this is that unit. This is the thing that I was writing as sum over some SK A bar SK A SK. Right. So you see that you sum over the site index here, and then there's four other indices that just stick out. And those connect up with the next one of these in the way drawn in the picture. Yeah, so that notation, I guess, could just be misleading. So really, I should have probably just written their indices out and not put sums over those indices. And then in front of the whole thing, there's a big sum over all the matrix indices in this pattern,
right? That's maybe a more honest. Yeah, here's a way of writing it that fixes that up. Okay, I realize what I was missing. The way I can clarify that is I can put a tensor product between these. I think that's the correct way to write it, actually. Yeah. So when you put a tensor product between them, it's saying that you're summing over the S's, and then you are simply just combining the matrix indices into some mega matrix. So you're not actually doing a matrix multiplication on the level of those indices. You're just fusing them together into some kind of enlarged Hilbert space, or not Hilbert space, but some enlarged matrix space, where you treat the row of one and the row of the other as some mega row, and the column of one and the column of the other as some mega column. Okay, that's really what you're doing, right? Because a normal tensor product otherwise would be some, like if we took two matrices and we just fused them together into some big matrix with doubled indices. And then here the only wrinkle is that there's also some internal sum that's happening at the same time. Okay, so that's what that tensor product notation up there means, is that this is the tensor product part, that's the sum over S, and you get something like this. All right. And this object is going to be important for us, okay, actually to focus on that. Before we do that, though, let's before we go back to this special object, let's just talk about a nice simplification that happens for the AKLT. And I'll actually argue that this can be made totally general. So let's restore. There was something else I wanted to say first. Let me do that first. So let's restore open boundary conditions. All right, so we had left that unspecified because I wanted to emphasize that this drawing can be applicable to infinite boundary conditions, periodic, open. But let's look for a minute at the case of open boundary conditions. And let's just take a small finite system and discuss that for a second. I want to discuss something a little bit technical, but it's important to realize if you're ever going to work with these as some kind of numerical method, right? Which is about costs, computational costs. Okay, and this is actually extremely important. I mean, this may seem technical, but without this, the whole scheme of MPS is sort of just a conceptual idea, but it's not really practically useful for anything. So the idea is that, first of all, costs in terms of representation, okay? Right, so we have this original full awful psi tensor, which is our entire many-body wave function, right? And we said that the site indices have size little d, right? So how many elements in general can there be in this object? How many different tensor elements is in that big blob? Say a little louder. Yeah, let's say we have n sites, so from 1 to n, and each one is of size d. D to the n, yeah. I didn't tell you guys enough about how many sites there were. So let's say there's n sites. Yeah, good. Okay, d to the n. It's a huge number, right? On the other hand, if we chop this thing down into a matrix product state, if we accept that we could decompose it as a matrix product state, which may not always be true, but you know, we're interested in that class of wave functions right now, ones that can be represented efficiently that way. And let's say this bond dimension is capital D, and all these have dimension D. And let's say that there's n of them. Still, same wave function, we've just somehow revealed some simplifying internal structure for it. Now how many elements are there? So think about that for a second, right? You know, forgetting about the ones at the edge, about that they may be special. Just focus on the ones internally, right? I'm just talking about how many numbers there are total before you try to combine them. So trying to combine them is what we'll talk about in a second. But let's just say how many numbers, if you tried to store this on a hard drive or something, how many numbers would you actually have to keep stored? It's d squared for each matrix, right? Okay, and then there's just n of them. So there's n times d squared, right? Times d, actually, little d. But yeah, that's right. Let's say in general there's n of these. You can actually get rid of that n in some cases.
All right, you might even be able to do this. That's a good point. But in general, let's say this is a system with open boundaries, and then it may have some edge effects, and you know, you can't always beat that n down to a 1. All right. So this is just an important point that this is a massive savings in terms of storage. And that may sound, again, kind of technical, like, you know, let the computer people deal with that. But this is also just kind of pretty profound, right? That there may be classes of wave functions where the vastness of Hilbert space is just like a total illusion, right? And that really all that's happening in this wave function could be represented by a vastly smaller number of variables, right? Such that they only grow linearly with the system size and sort of polynomially with some other measure of the complexity of the wave function that we'll try to get a better handle on what it means. All right, so that's a really important realization. And then, so that's the cost of representation. There's also a cost of computation. Okay, and let's think about this cost. So if we try to compute an expectation value back with this full blob, this just kind of arbitrary full wave function that's the biggest type we can get our hands on. All right, then we have some sum, basically, that is like sum over S1, S2, through Sn, and we also have, there's some Sj prime, that's just a detail. There's an additional sum here we have to do, because this one has two indices, one on the top of the operator, one on the bottom of the operator, right, over some amplitudes that we have to deal with. All right, so we can understand the cost of this thing by just counting how many sums we have to do, right? And then just multiplying all that work together. So we have to sum over S1 from 1 to D, S2 from 1 to D. We have to do all those sums, right? So, you know, the number of terms in that sum should again be D to the N, okay? You know, maybe with some little correction because of the fact that we have to do an extra sum for that one operator, but I'm not too worried about that extra D cost, okay? So again, it's some exponentially many number of terms we have to sum over, so it's really bad. All right, so that's, again, setting it up, that's really horrible. So let's look over here. Basically, what's nice is when you stare at this for a second, you realize there's a strategy for summing this thing down. At first, you may say, isn't this the same, right? We have to sum over this line, right? It may even be worse because we have these outer lines or something that we have to sum over, right? Well, let's leave off the outer lines, actually. Let's think of this as just the end of the system. It looks like it's the same. But what you find is that you can actually, there is a much more efficient strategy. So what you can do is you can take, say, one of these, and then just sum it with another one. And when you do, you see that this sum, so this is a lesson for you guys of how to count these kinds of costs. You just count everything that's being summed. So here's a line that's being summed over that takes D values internally. Okay, and then here's a line that takes D, and here's a line that takes D. So even though these aren't being summed, you have to hold them fixed through various values, fixed yet arbitrary. So you have to let these range over all their values. This one has to range over D values. This one has to range over D values. This one has to be summed over little D values. So you get a D times D squared. All right. Then you attach the next one. Right? So now you get a D. This one has to be summed, right? Because we're connecting that line. And this one has to be summed. So you get a D times a D cubed, right? And so on. And then from then on, everything you get is going to be order D cubed, OK? You can just see. Because basically, after that, you're just attaching more, and you have to deal with D, D, and D, 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 and D like that. You just keep having only to deal with three of these large D indices. All right? Any questions about that? That might have gone a little fast, so you know, stop me if that. Right? So we put the next one. And again, when you add this next one, you're going to have to do a sum over this one, which is D. And you're going to have to hold this open and hold that open and let them range through all the values as you fill out, you know, all these values as you do these sums repeatedly. So again, it's going to be little D times D cubed. So in the end, we find that the cost is just D cubed, right?
And in practice, so you see for the AKLT, what was capital D for this AKLT wave function that we've been studying? It was just 2, right? It's about as small as it can be and not and be non-trivial. And already we saw that was a pretty rich wave function, right? It was the ground state of some fairly realistic Hamiltonian. And in practice, you can study, you know, almost all kind of spin Hamiltonians in 1D that I've looked at that have a gap. You can find that taking capital D just to be around 100 or 200 is enough, and you can get extremely good accuracy with matrix product states. And so computers are great at dealing with tasks that are like 100 cubed, 200 cubed. It's nothing for a modern computer, right? On the other hand, there's no computer you can build that can deal with this, right? You have to build a computer the size of like the known universe or something to deal with this. Once n exceeds a few hundred, it would just break any computer you could ever imagine making. So this is just a massive reduction in cost. All right, and that's actually computing the whole thing. That's contracting this entire network of MPS tensors. Mm-hmm.
Is that what you've mentioned here? Does not have any dependence on n, the number of sides?
This does. So we should put that in. Okay. So in the end, well, that this I was just saying each term is like order d cubed. So overall, you'd get an n d cubed d type of cost. Yeah, that's a good point. But that's exactly that's to do the whole thing. So now we'll see that in many cases you don't even have to do as much as that, actually. That's right. Yeah, these are all some fixed tensors that we've already fixed. So for the AKLT wave function, we had written the other day that you know, for the plus state it was proportional to sigma plus, for the zero it was sigma z, and then for the minus it was sigma minus. So there's some particular form you can have in mind. But in general, we can obtain these MPSs from other calculations. Like there was some exact form. We could also obtain them numerically, and we can talk about how to do that a little bit later. I think part of the tutorial, you'll also be writing down matrix product states for other interesting classes of wave functions as well. So you'll get a little practice with figuring out what numbers can actually go in these. Okay, so let's go back actually now for a second to this AKLT wave function. And we'll see that it has an interesting property that actually can be generalized. All right. And remember, as I said a second ago, this we have a plus is square root of 2/3 sigma plus. A zero was minus square root of 1/3 sigma z. And a minus was minus square root of 2/3 sigma minus. Okay, that's the actual form we have for the AKLT. And remember, these A's are these guys, right? So we are putting plus, zero, or minus on this physical index and getting 3 different matrices that could go in this slot. Then, you know, every amplitude is just a product of those matrices once we've selected them. So let's see if we let's terminate our finite size matrix product state by just tracing out the indices at the edge. Okay, let's just define our edge that way, right, for the AKLT state. And then we could link this up with a system as long as we want. But let's just make our left edge have this form. It's just a choice, right? You can think of this as being some funny special tensors at the left that we do that with or something. But we're just going to terminate the edge of the system by tracing out those last outer indices, all right? And let's see what we get for AKLT when we do that, right? So first, let's set this index to be plus. We have to sum over this index, right? And so what we'll get is we'll get 2/3 sigma minus sigma plus as a matrix multiplication. We're doing the matrix multiplication over this index, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so let's just say, let's do the, yeah, I didn't motivate this that well. So let's say there's actually one site previously, right? And this one site previously, let's just make these tensors something funny. So I'm going to color these like a different, I'm going to shade these in. Let's just make these some funny choice that they have the property that when you contract over this index, they reduce to just being an identity tensor like that. Okay, does that suit you guys? So then here what we're doing is we're starting out by choosing some impurity tensor or some funny boundary tensor that is, you know, this is going to be way out at the edge of our system, so we're not too concerned with what we put here. We're interested in computing some bulk property efficiently. So let's just choose to set these up that when you contract over this line, you just get an identity, and we can easily do that. Just put a matrix here and put its inverse here, right? And just choose them to be 2 by 2, 3 by 3 matrices, so that, or 3 by 2, so that this has 3 values, and then it's like a spin 1. And it can be just about anything, all right? So let's just start it off that way. So that's a good question, because otherwise that boundary looks kind of unphysical, right? It looks like the bra and the ket are somehow linked up in an unphysical way, right? But let's just think about it that way. So now when we do this sum, all right, let's move it down here. First, let's set this to plus, and we get 2/3 sigma minus sigma plus, because what we're doing is this was sigma plus transpose up here, or dagger, and this is sigma plus. So when we transpose it and flip it around, this is going to become sigma minus times sigma plus, all right? When we set this to 0, this is going to be 1/3 sigma z, sigma z. And then when we set this to minus, just by symmetry, you know, this is going to be sigma minus dagger on top. This is going to be sigma minus on the bottom. So we'll get 2/3 sigma plus, sigma minus. And now as a matrix, this is just, let's see. So this is sigma plus can act on a downspin. And then sigma minus will flip it back. So it's this matrix. Okay, it's like a projector. And this is just the opposite. This is just the, I don't know if inverse is the right word, but the complementary projector. Okay, it's easy to work out. And this is just an identity matrix, because the minus sign on this one undoes the minus sign on that one. So when you add these all up, you just get 2/3 plus 1/3 in this entry, which is 1, and 2/3 plus 1/3 in the other diagonal entry, 1. Okay. So we see that this MPS tensor has the following property, that when we trace over this outer virtual index here, but leave these unsummed, leave these free, then they kind of cancel into an identity. Okay, so this is a nice property that we can exploit. And I'll show you in a second, or I'll just argue in a second, that this can actually be always chosen to be the case for an arbitrary matrix product state. We can go through in more detail how to constructively do that. But you know, I'm just going to assert that you can always actually choose this. But for the AKLT, it just comes that way. You know, already by choosing these particular values for the A's, this just happens. Okay, so again, if you like, we're choosing some funny boundary conditions by just putting some matrix here and its inverse here. So, but it's just some kind of crazy choice out at the end that we don't care too much about, just to kick things off. Right? And similarly, you can show, you can kind of see that everything here is pretty symmetrical. So you can also show that the same thing happens from the right. And so in general, if we chain a lot of these together, let's say we're measuring something deep in the bulk of this wave function. So here we're looking at, say, the right edge. All right, and we have some operator way to the left that we're going to measure. So we've made one of these sandwiches with an operator somewhere deep in the middle of the wave function. That basically this is going to start canceling pairwise. Right, and so on. So no matter how many of these we chain together like this, if we started out properly, they'll just cancel pairwise and always turn into an identity, as long as they don't encounter anything but an identity operator on the sites. All right. So this may seem just like a curiosity of the AKLT wave function, but it can actually be chosen for any MPS. You can choose it to have this kind of property, surprisingly. All right.
So this means that if I'm taking a expectation value of any operator, I just put
Yep, exactly. So let's see that. Let's see. I don't think I caught the whole question. So.
I guess it's kind of like this seems so wonderful that on Mars, this means the boundary conditions
Oh, okay. I see. You're saying this seems too nice. Like somehow we have information in the wave function that's getting erased.
Yeah.
It's too forgetful of the boundaries or something.
Yeah. How can people like check what happens if you have
So we'll see that things decay exponentially in general in MPS. So that partly gives you an intuition that the boundaries have an effect, but it's not very strong on the bulk. That's not actually exactly what's going on here. We'll see that for the case of measuring a single site operator right now, this cancellation really happens almost perfectly. For the case of measuring two operators that are separated by some distance, you can't simply reduce it to just measuring one, measuring the other. The ones in the middle stay open, stay around, and you have to deal with them. So let's see that right now. That's where we're headed with this. So in the end, we make this funny sandwich, right? So we let's do that thing again of putting these kind of special edge tensors that kick this process off in some fashion, right? So we make this operator sandwich where we want to measure some operator on a particular site. Okay, we do something at the edge that kicks this process off, and then okay, then we get that, and then if you just repeatedly apply this kind of logic, then you find that in the end, all we get is the following. We just get a measurement that only involves the MPS tensor at site J and our operator, right? So this is pretty shocking. So I already showed you that you can do the entire calculation. This is why I was saying sort of hold on about this N. You can do the entire calculation without making any assumptions about the structure of the MPS whatsoever, otherwise, other than that the matrices are D by D, which could even be an upper bound for their size, say. And you can do the whole thing in some kind of polynomial time, so like linear in system size, polynomial in complexity of the MPS tensors. But in fact, if you set things up correctly, then it's just some kind of order one, you know, d squared kind of cost here. So it's completely independent of the system size. You could just go and do this on every site. OK. So I'm not going to, unless you guys want me to go into great detail, I'm not going to go too in-depth right now about how you actually set this up for an arbitrary MPS, but I should just mention that you can always set this up. So you can demand this property for a more general MPS. Sometimes this means you have to have additional tensors decorating the network, but the way you demand this property is that you realize that if you take some small unit of the matrix product state, so two of these matrix product state tensors in a row, that there's some gauge freedom, if you will. I mean, I don't know if I should call this gauge because it's not always like the same meaning of gauge in every different branch of physics. But basically, there's some internal freedom that you can play around with where you can put two matrices on this bond. And as long as you choose this matrix G arbitrarily, as long as you choose it to be invertible and put its inverse there, then you can see that if I do this contraction first, that these just cancel back to the identity, and it's the same thing. And so this is extremely large, you know, gauge degeneracy in some sense, because I can put any D by D matrix G as long as it's invertible here and put its inverse. So you can play around with these states quite a bit. And then I could show you guys, but I'd rather talk about something else for a minute, in general, you can always choose this G such that you can demand this property of cancellation for any MPS. Okay. That's right. Yeah, exactly. So you could absorb them together. Yeah, thanks for asking to clarify that. That helps. Okay, so you can absorb them together like this and redefine the matrices. That's right. So that's what I mean by a gauge symmetry, is that it's the same physical state, right? No measurement you could do on the physical indices could see that that had happened. But it could have consequences for this cancellation. Let's convince ourselves about this cancellation. That I think it's pretty easy to convince ourselves that there's a G that does this. So all we do is we say, let's have our original MPS tensors that maybe don't have this cancellation property, right? And then let's have this G chosen there. Let's already have this G in place. This is like G dagger. All right, so then we can sum over all these lines. Let's sum over this line, let's sum over that line. And when we do, we get something that's just G dagger, sum matrix, and G. And this matrix is not the identity, right? So if this property already holds, this matrix we had said was the identity. And so then all we have to do is just, let's see. Yes, so what we can do in general is, for simplicity, let's assume this is a symmetric matrix, just to be simple about it. Maybe that's not always valid, but you can decompose this as just U, some diagonal D. And U dagger, let's say it's Hermitian just for simplicity, and you can generalize this yourself. And then all you have to do is choose G to be U times square root, or D to the minus 1/2, okay, in this case. So all it does is that G, so U would be unitary, so that would cancel with this U, and then this is the negative square root of this diagonal matrix D, so that would cancel off half of that, and the same thing would happen from the other side, and you would just get an identity, right? So that's just as a proof of principle that you can choose such a G to make this happen, right? And then you could just decorate your whole MPS through with this kind of thing, all right? So mainly I just wanted you guys to take away, there's this huge gauge freedom and you can use it, you can basically take an MPS and you can put it into various different gauges, and by choosing this gauge specially, you can reduce the cost of calculations drastically. All right, that's basically the point. But now let's look at the structure of correlations in an MPS, all right? So let's see what correlation functions are look like and how they're realized. So let's say we want to take a state that we're representing as a matrix product state and measure two operators at sites I and J that are just local on-site operators. And let's think of these as being fixed but arbitrary. Right, so we encounter one operator on site I. Then we have a bunch of MPS tensors that are just surrounding identity operators through the region between I and J. Then over at site J, we have the other operator. Okay, then if you like, we have these edge tensors that I've chosen specially just to kick off this whole cancellation property, you know, however you want to think about that. There's other ways you could start that off. You could have an infinite MPS, and you can show that in a certain gauge, the dominant eigenvector is actually that identity tensor. So there's different ways of getting this started, this process started. So you can either think of this as being the result of having an infinite number of tensors off to the side, or just choosing special boundary conditions. So then just again, by applying that cancellation property, the whole left edge goes away because these are just surrounding identities, and everything cancels up until we hit this operator. Once we have this operator, we can't apply this rule anymore because this rule needed there to be just a sum over these side indices, but now there's not. There's some operator sitting there. So in general, that will spoil that rule, that property. Okay, we get something like this. And that's as much as you can simplify it to start with. Okay, so that's really the network you have to contract. I mean, that's as far as you can take this cancellation, I mean. You can't ask for more cancellation than that. So you see in some sense that now, just intuitively, you can see that these operators will be correlated, right? And that's satisfying, because I mean, if we had just found that these pop apart into two of these separate operator measurements, something would be deeply wrong, right? Like we would have said we have this whole class of wave functions, but they have no correlations like whatsoever. So it's kind of pleasing that something is carrying the correlations here, all right? But intuitively, just to see what's about to come next, there's gonna be this matrix that repeats, but this matrix only has a certain size. So some intuitive sense, there's only sort of so much correlations that it can carry, if you will, because it only has some fixed size. And let's make that more precise, all right? So, we've been kind of mostly assuming that we just have a translation invariant in PS with the same tensor A. So let's define this object here. Let's call this T for transfer matrix, all right? And this thing is this object A bar S tensor AS, all right? Just defining that guy. And here I've left the number of them to be arbitrary. You can see that those just repeat. We just have T, T again. It's the same object repeating through if these A's are all chosen to be the same. So what we get is some kind of impurity edge tensor. We can even go ahead and do all these internal sums over this left guy. We just have some funny tensor at the edge with two lines. And then we have T raised to, if we think of it as a matrix, we can think of this as T raised to some power P. Let's just call it P. P is equal to J minus I, but I don't want to have to write J minus I every time. All right? So then we can actually get some insight as to what's going on here by diagonalizing T, okay? So again, you can think of T as a matrix by grouping these indices together. This is what this tensor product means, right? It means take these two matrices and then just kind of fuse them together into some enlarged matrix, like a matrix of matrices. All right, that's what that means. And in the picture, it just means group these lines together and think of, instead of this running over d values, think of this as just some collective index that runs over d squared values, all right, in some order. The order doesn't matter terribly much, but as long as you just choose an order and stick to it, all right? So let's diagonalize this matrix as q lambda q inverse, which again in pictures means that we have decomposed it as follows. This tensor is like Q, and this one is like Q inverse, and then this is lambda, all right? And again, this is a matrix in the sense that this is a collective index, collective row index, and this is the column index of that matrix. And then the inverse is just flipped around. Row index is the column of the other, and this is some collective column index, okay? So it's fair to call these matrices as long as you think of this as collective, all right? If you want, we can bend them down like this. And then, this is some diagonal matrix in the middle, all right? So this is general. You know, you might worry about whether this is in general diagonalizable, but you'll just grant me that, okay, that it's diagonalizable. So then we see that T to the P is just Q lambda to the P, Q inverse, straightforwardly. It's the familiar result. So finally, what that means diagrammatically, okay?
Mm-hmm. This T here, you said it's not actually a matrix. And I'm really worried because it sounds like you're trying to concatenate two of the matrix indices into one of them.
and then treat the whole thing like a new matrix, but then like matrix you've got to be really careful with your new like matrix products, because they're not going to look the same as the old one. And, like the old one, you have the rows and columns are like mixing together when you actually multiply them.
Oh, you're just talking about bookkeeping issue? Like,
yeah.
If I fuse these together, how do I, have I lost track of like which setting goes with which of these two lines or something?
Well, if you fuse these, so normally if I was to do like a, if I was to do a matrix, like a take two matrix and multiply them, I take the first row and multiply it with the first one.
Mm-hmm.
So now, when I, if I'm trying to, that's not just simply like multiplication element. If I was to combine these matrix indices, then I'd get something like that. And I'd be kind of worried that it doesn't. Can you combine them in a different way so that you probably can?
I mean, I think in the end, you have to just kind of do some of this. If you're concerned about those kind of issues, I don't know if I don't know the right words to say to totally like make you see that it's not a big problem, but you can just conceptually think of these as being fused, and if you like, you can always keep them as separate. And so then when I'm saying matrix, I'm only saying matrix to the extent that these kinds of decompositions are still valid. So in some sense, that's all I mean, is that you can just conceptually say it's a matrix. That lets you say there's an eigenvalue decomposition. Once I'm done saying that, it's back to being a tensor. So you can just think of it on that level. Right, but there are basically another way is that you can simply fuse them together and have some rule for how you do that, and then just remember what rule you used, and then do everything, and then if you need to recover those two, you just undo that rule in a consistent way. It's not a problem. Yeah.
I mean, you've already mentioned this, but if you fuse the endpoints, how are you contracting later with the extreme for that?
Yeah, a kind of similar question, I guess. Like, how do you, if you merge these together into some big index, how are you going to connect it with this? You can simply apply the same rule to these as well. So whatever rule you use to combine those, you just use that same rule, or maybe the inverse of that rule to combine these. Or you actually never combine them. You just think of them in the back of your mind as being combined for the purposes of computing this, but that's just a conceptual thing. Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you guys are thinking about this, because it's important to think these things through. Okay, so you could just say that permit me to call this a matrix temporarily, just so that I can assert there is an eigenvalue decomposition of this matrix. Then once I've believed that, that means that that I can decompose this matrix in this form. But maybe I never actually have to join these two indices together. Maybe they were always separate, and I never combined them.
So the purpose of using them was just to have two index object instead of four.
That's right. So just to fuse them, just to say that the same decompositions we can apply to matrices, we can apply to some funny object. Like that's the idea, if you like. There's different ways. I mean, I have a code that does this, and in fact, we have a thing that does merge them into one. And all we do is we save that it's like an object and an object-oriented code, and we just save that object. And then later, when we need those indices back, we apply it again, and it just undoes whatever it did. So there's just different ways of doing it. But again, you can even write a generalized eigen decomposer that works with multi-index objects as well, and you'd be in the same boat. So it's good to think about these things. Right. So let's see what we wrote. Okay. So in general, what you find back in kind of tensor notation is that you have found that raising t to the p is nothing but taking this to the p power, and the q and the q inverse just go along for the ride, right? Because they cancel pairwise as you multiply this over and over again with itself. And you just are left with an outer Q and an outer Q inverse. So you just get this leftover result. Right? So these outer guys are just some arbitrary thing. Remember, we haven't really said what O and O, OI and OJ are. They could be even different operators. Okay, it's just totally general. So these outer tensors are just some unspecified guys. But what we'll find is that in the limit that we take p to be large, because we're interested now in the asymptotic behavior of these correlation functions. So in general, the short range behavior will be something messy and complicated that will depend on which particular matrix product state we're studying and what operators we choose. Okay, and that's just something that you just have to compute. You just compute it from this kind of network directly. Okay, but if we want to study the asymptotics, we can think of taking p to be large. Then what we have is some kind of funny left edge tensor connecting to some matrix. Now I'm going to open up this matrix and write its elements. And in general, I haven't shown you guys this, but in general, the first element is one. And this just comes from the state being normalized. We can discuss why that is. In a sense, that's if you choose identity operators here, then there has to be some guy one there so that you can always have a normalized state so that this kind of thing doesn't vanish. If this wasn't one, then if you take p large enough, all of these are going to vanish and you won't get a norm of one. So that's one. Okay, and then there's some subleading guy, lambda 2, that's being raised to the p power. And there's also some other stuff that's smaller. So here I'm choosing these eigenvalues to go in descending order. Okay, and you can show in general that the spectral radius of this guy lambda is you can show that all its eigenvalues are actually equal to 1 or less. Okay, and in general, there's a unique guy that's 1 if you choose the state to be normalized, and all the others are less. Okay, you can just convince yourself of this by locality and it being normalized and this sort of thing. We can discuss that in more detail. Okay, but in general, there's 1, and then there's some other guy that is subleading. Okay, and it can vary depending on the physics. Okay, and then you can also convince yourself that unless these are chosen specially to be the identity, that in general, you're going to, or basically what you can do is you can subtract off any constant contributions. So you see any element here that's going to connect to this index is going to have some contribution that's independent of p. So that's like a finite expectation value part, right? So in general, there's going to be some const, which may or may not be 0. It just depends on whether you're measuring something that has a finite expectation value in the state. Like it could be like some density of particles or something. We could subtract that off by measuring a connected correlator if we want. But it's just there or not. Okay. And then you have some subleading part that's some c times lambda 2 to the p power. And this is the result we're really after. All right. Understanding that part. So again, if you want, we could subtract off the we can make the so-called connected correlator, where we subtract off the expectation values of the individual operators, and that would kill off this constant piece. Okay, so we can just study that connected correlator if you're concerned about this constant. All right, so what have we shown? We've shown that the connected correlator of some arbitrary operators I and j, arbitrary as long as they're not special operators like the identity that would actually measure the norm of our state, then that constant would be 1. Okay, we've shown that in the limit that j minus I, which was our power p here, goes to infinity, we get some lambda 2 to the j minus I power. Okay, and then we can rewrite this as okay, just suggestively, we can say that's e to the log lambda 2 inside. So that's e to the j minus I log lambda 2. And then we can finally write this. We can define some number c. All right, that's just defined by this last equation. Okay, and then what we find is that this c is minus 1 over log of, here I'm putting in magnitude of lambda 2. Let's put that in, OK? And so this is what you find. So this is some, we could even call this C max, OK? Because at short distances, there'll be other lambdas that survive for a while this P is large but not so large. So there'll be other exponential decays. Those will all die first. And finally, there'll be one longest lived one. Because lambda 2, here I was thinking of putting these eigenvalues as ordered. So there's always an eigenvalue that's 1. And again, you can convince yourself by just putting in identities into this correlator and then arguing that no matter how long of an NPS you have to get 1 for those identities, because otherwise the state's norm would be going to 0 or going to infinity or something awful. There has to be a way of computing the norm of the state. So there has to be a 1, and then the other ones descend from that. And otherwise, correlators would blow up. So you can focus on this subleading guy, lambda 2, and then you can show that everything eventually decays exponentially with this particular correlation length. So it's interesting because this correlation length is a bound on all correlators, okay? And it's just a property of the wave function. Actually, it's a local property of this NPS. Okay, so it's interesting. You can just go inspect some local property of this matrix product state. And from this local property, which is the eigenvalues of this transfer operator T, you can do some study of it, and then you can actually compute a bound on all correlators. So you don't actually have to do the experiment of putting in different operators. So this is extremely valuable. Okay, and then you'll be doing this in the tutorial today for the AKLT state. Yeah. Great, okay. Yeah, it should be an interesting exercise. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the question is proof that you don't get phase transitions. Yeah, well, you do get phase transitions in 1D, and matrix product states aren't the end of the story in 1D. Yeah, so you can think of basically as you go through a second order, you know, quantum phase transition in 1D, you can kind of picturesquely imagine using representing all states as matrix product states if you want, just conceptually, and you can imagine that this capital D, which is the MPS bond dimension, just gets fatter and fatter and fatter, and then at some point, at a critical point, it diverges formally. So you have some kind of your matrix product state explodes. Actually, it turns into a mirror, in some sense, is what it turns into, which is like some tower of tensors. We can talk about that later, all right? And then as you go through that transition, it comes back down to some finite matrix product state again. Okay, so somehow matrix product states blow up right at phase transitions. But let's discuss that briefly. Okay, this won't take but a minute. MPS for critical systems. So just as a, you'll see if you read some of the literature, a lot of papers will start out with a quip saying something like, matrix product states don't describe critical systems. They'll just sort of say this offhandedly at the beginning of a paper. But it's pretty misleading. So we see that matrix product states, this is one lesson here, right? Matrix product states of finite bond dimension correspond to gapped, ground states of gapped phases. Maybe excited states too, but in general, as you go to high-lying excited states after a while, their properties don't resemble finite D matrix product states for other reasons involving entanglement that we can discuss. Okay. But matrix product states of finite D, in the sense of having this kind of correlation functions, correspond generally to gapped ground states. And we'll discuss, there's actually a proof of this in some rigorous sense that we can discuss briefly tomorrow. Okay. Also by Matt Hastings, who proved this extension of Liebschultz-Mattis. So this guy's proving a lot of interesting things. Really briefly, matrix product states for critical systems. What happens is that critical systems correlators go asymptotically as power laws. So there's some kind of exponent, depending on which operators you put here. There's some exponent, say, like 2 delta or something. OK, well, let's just call it delta. All right, and depending on what operators you put. But in general, you have some power law to all distances. So it's a totally different behavior asymptotically from what you can get from any finite dimension matrix product state like this. All right. So that seems problematic. But in practice, what happens is you simply find that if you choose some bond dimension D1, that you can actually reproduce power law decays for a while. So this is distance J minus I. So up to some distance, you actually can reproduce power laws. What's happening is there's some very delicate interplay of all these different decays of all these other lambdas, like lambda 3, lambda 4, and so on. They're all mixing in some special way to reproduce power law physics, a sort of local critical physics. But then at some point, lambda 2 wins and takes over and it dies. Okay, this would be on some log scale. So this is showing the magnitude of this correlator on some log scale. Okay. And then if you do some different D2, it'll match, and then it'll go further and then die again. And some D3, it'll do that and die again. So this is with increasing the bond dimension. And so this is where I'm saying you allow some maximum bond dimension, and then you obtain the best MPS that minimizes the energy. So you're kind of thinking of these as variational states to try to get the best representation of the ground state of some critical system. You just find that, you know, you actually can get the right local physics. So in particular, the energy for local Hamiltonian only sees about this much distance, right? Because often critical systems can still be described by local Hamiltonians with, say, next neighbor or second neighbor interactions or something. And so the energy will come out great. And so will correlators out to some distance. But then eventually you'll see that there's something funny going on and that it's not truly a critical wave function in the sense of having unity overlap with the true wave function, if you could write the true wave function. So something is funny. Something funny is happening at long distances. But these distances can be huge. You can take the d to be a few hundred, and you can get distances of many thousands of sites. Okay. So these have a huge amount of representational power, even for critical systems. But in some formal sense, they're not the right wave function for critical systems. Well, you don't really get to pick the number of sites. So in condensed matter, we're often after the thermodynamic limit. So we really would like to have the right physics on an infinite number of sites. But yeah, you're right. It's better if you are content with measuring properties out to short distances, if that's all you need. Like measuring the energy, you only need to have this correct system short distance. And you can get good energies. Mm-hmm. Is that what you were asking? It depends on what you want. Yeah, exactly. So in the end, it's unsatisfactory. But what you can do, for instance, there's a neat paper by Joel Moore from a few years ago where they check predictions of field theory about asymptotic correlation functions. So what they're after in particular is connecting these values, deltas, back to microscopic parameters of the model they're studying. So what they did is they just studied it using matrix product state techniques. There's methods like DMRG and other methods for obtaining the best matrix product state for a given, you know, for a fixed D for a given Hamiltonian. And they simply just would fit to here. And then once things started dying, they stopped fitting. And then they would push a little more and fit a little more. And after a while, their fits would hold over some huge distance. And they were content with using that for their fit. And they simply just didn't try to fit. So there, they were actually using this to their advantage to indicate the distance to which they could trust a given D. And they would just use this to verify that this matrix product state is trustworthy at least to like this distance. So we're just only going to fit here. So they would actually use this as a signal to say, what distance can we trust? And then you only just fit with this data, and they would got great results. So you just have to be a little smart about it. It's just a little more delicate. OK, that's it for the day, unless you guys have more questions you want to ask.